Well, it is 2020 hours, March 22nd, 2023, Ward Green here. 2020 hours. 2020 hours. That's in 21 seconds, just at that moment, too, just about a few seconds ago now. So, welcome to today's study. It's very exciting, as it was yesterday, more or less the beginning of our earnest chronological exactitude in our understanding of the truth about the chronology of the world insofar as it's manifested in the chronology that we call the Blessed Genealogy, which originally started out to be a research into my own family history because I had some interesting discoveries that I made that I thought might be connected to my family. But in the end, although I did do a lot of research on my family as well, it became apparent to me that it was far more important to find out the sacred chronology of the Bible, which is also something that many biblical archaeologists have considered something analogous to the Holy Grail of biblical archaeology, which is, that is to say, the chronology of the world is the Holy Grail of biblical archaeology and the study of Bible history, in other words. So, we would like to know that we could put the Bible into history. So today, let's begin our study with Abraham, whom we have been studying already in the book of Genesis, and hopefully will continue today. But in the time of the article Green, when I wrote the first, this was the first article, the very first article that documented the genealogy, or the dates, I should say, associated with the genealogy for the patriarchs all the way back to Adam. But during, because it was an early article, the article Green did not document in the text of the article what this chronology was, but by the time the writing of the article was complete, the chronology had been determined, and it was presented at much greater length in the next article called Joseph, which is different from Joseph and On, which is the following article after Joseph. So in the article Green, at the very end of the article, I decided to include the dating, which would appear in the next article, in the article Green, but I put it at the beginning of the article Green. Okay, so here we're looking at the beginning of the article Green, and it's a table, and we see that in 1914, Jacob moved to Egypt with his family at the age of 130 years old. And in 1923 BCE, that was 1914 BCE, in 1923 BCE, as we've already discussed, Joseph, 9 years prior to Jacob's coming down to Egypt during the famine, Joseph stood before Pharaoh at the age of 30, and that was 1923. And then we know when Joseph was born, it was 30 years before that. But Jacob was born in 2044, approximately, possibly 2045. That was when Isaac was 60 years old. And Isaac, as we see here, was born in 2105 when Abraham was 100 years old. So that means that Abraham was born in 2206, allowing for some extra months, in addition to his age of 100. Didn't mean that he was exactly 100. And also, Canaan, being the land where Abraham settled at the age of 75, that would be in the year 2131 when Abraham was 75, or very close to the year 2131 when Abraham settled in Canaan. Perhaps the year 2131 30, because, of course, our calendar differs from the calendar that they were using in terms of when the year began. So we don't have to be year accurate here. So this is very interesting. Partly it's interesting also because Abraham was born 2,200 years before the birth of Christ. It's a very round number, with Christ being born in 6 BCE. It's a very round number. Then we can go back. Now, the reason I wanted to show you this table, little children, is because it enables us to calculate back, knowing how old each of these patriarchs was when they had their son, or not knowing, but believing, based on what we've been told. In every case, we're not sure. For example, in the case of Terah, some people differ on how old Terah was when he had his son Abraham. But we have used the number 70 for the age of Terah at the birth of Abraham. And we've used Nahor as 79 from the Septuagint. So, and we've used the Septuagint throughout here. So all these numbers are 100 years larger than in the Masoretic text. But as we calculate back and add these numbers together, we get back the birth date of each of the patriarchs all the way back to, well, to the flood, the deluge, in 3282, when Noah was 599 years old, in his 600th year. Also, or 600 years old, I mean, we don't know because of the ambiguity of the beautiful Hebrew language. Arpakshad was born 2 years after the deluge, so 3280 is the birth of Arpakshad, BCE years. And Kainan, he's the one that was omitted from the Masoretic text, but he's here. We have him here, and he pushes the chronology a little higher because we have to add the age of Kainan when he had his son, Shelah, and that adds 130 years to the chronology, plus all the extra hundreds of years that were added because of the use of the Septuagint, which has got more years in it to add together than the Masoretic text does. And we get back to a time of the deluge which is very much in harmony with the time that archaeologists call the Bronze Age, which is the beginning of the refinement of bronze, which would have begun after the earth was devastated by the deluge and men had to begin forging tools again from bronze. So the Bronze Age corresponds very well with the time of the deluge, about roughly 3,000 years before Christ. And 3282 is the very exact date that we have. Noah was born 600 years earlier, or 3882 BCE. And we can calculate all the way back using the ages of the patriarchs at the births of their sons. And we get Adam was created in 5550 BCE. So that's how we get all of the dates for these patriarchs. And that's how we also have arrived at the date for the deluge. Okay? So today's study, interestingly, was going to be paragraph 4-9. 4 plus 9 is 13, and 1-3, subtract 1 from 3, we get 2. Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't. 1 plus 3 is 4, or 4 plus 9 is 13, and 1 plus 3 is 4. Taking the two digits from 13, and 4 is the same as 2 plus 2, which is the sum of the two digits in today's date, March 22nd. 2 plus 2 is 4. So we're doing this paragraph, and in the Ark of Urartu we talked about the building of the tower, and it's true that there was a man called Phineas Farsa in the Irish tradition who was, according to the Irish lineage of record that we have from the ancient Irish sources, Phineas Farsa was one of the early descendants of Japheth, and he was alive at the time of the construction of the tower and of the dispersion of the people when the languages were confused. So Phineas Pharsa was the one who created the Gaelic alphabet at that time, record says, so the documentation claims from the ancient, so the ancient sources say. And he also talks about this 43 years of the tower being constructed. So if we look at, but the other source, the primary source for the construction of the tower being a period of 43 years is from the Book of Jubilees, chapter 10, verse 21. It says 43 years they were building it. And that was in the land of Shinar. So they were building, it talks about a lot of details about the building and so on. It's all interesting, but it's not something we rely on for the truth, not in the same way we rely on the Bible. It's not considered to be a work inspired by God, but if we need a number, we can get this number 43 from this book. If we're trying to find a date for how long, a number for how long they were building the tower, then it's obtained in this place, among others, 43 years they were building the tower. Because that's a numeral, or I mean, it's a mathematical quantity, and it's a number. Then it's less likely to be mistranslated. Perhaps it's less likely to be miscalculated. It's less likely to be miscopied, etc. It's just a number. Right, 43. So maybe it's got more credibility because it's a number. But we don't have any other source, so we're going to use 43 as our sort of approximation for how long they were building the tower. But Mr. Jackson wrote a book. John Jackson wrote a book. And his book was very... what year was it? I think it was in the 1700s. Mr. John Jackson, he's a very famous chronologer, and his book was called Chronological Antiquities, if I recall correctly. He's got two volumes, and I think it's from 1750 something, 1751 or 1752. Well, anyway, we can look it up. Let's look it up. Chronological Antiquities. Chronological, is it here? There it is. Chronological Antiquities. Do I have a reference to it somewhere? 1752. He wrote this book in 1752, Chronological Antiquities. Why is this? Oh yeah, because I magnified it. Okay. So in 1752, Mr. Jackson writes this this detail about 22 years. According to Mr. Jackson, the difference between, where are we here? Well, that's in chapter 5. Okay. So just go back one more. Or two more? Where is it? Oh, okay. We're just going to go back to where we know where we're currently reading. There it is. 22 more years. So I didn't write... Yeah, right. A 22-year interval. That explains why the search didn't find it. 22-year interval. From the... Okay. In this city, not the city of Shinar, but the land of Shinar. The land of Shinar was the land in between the rivers, which included the River Euphrates, and it's in the land near the Persian Gulf, to the west of the Persian Gulf, in the land of Mesopotamia, which means between the rivers. And it was east of Israel, this land of Shinar, but Israel was not in existence at this time. This is shortly after the deluge, when men traveled to Shinar and built the tower, which we read about in Genesis already. They were in a place which was established before there were any other countries. So when Egypt was established shortly after this, the first king of Shinar, when we look at the kings of Egypt, right here, first king of Egypt was called Menes, but it's not clear whether he was the king of Egypt or Shinar. And then there was Thoth, we see here the name of a man called Athothis, or Athostis. That looks very much like the name Thoth. So we know that Nimrod and Thoth were talked about. Nimrod has the letters N and M in it, just like Menes has M and N. So there are similarities in the names that lead us logically to surmise that the first ruler here, Menes, applies to possibly Shinar and Nimrod. And the second name is Thoth, possibly, and Egypt. It would make good sense. You know, knowing very little about this time period, as we do, we know very little about it. This is the very first of the Egyptian dynasties, according to Julius Africanus on the left and Eusebius on the right. And they differ because they had different sources in what they used for information about these ancient times. So the different manuscripts were corrupted over the years, but this is the best that we have, and we've got very good similarity between Thoth and the second king here. And Menes, well, he could be the father of Nimrod, of course, because we know there was somebody called in the Bible. I should say the father of Nimrod had a name like Mestrium or something. What was it? Mizrium? Mizrium. Or was it something else? I'm trying to remember. There is a person called Mizrium, and that's similar to Menes also. So that's... I want to cover this scripture today, Proverbs 27:2. May a stranger and not your own mouth praise you. May a foreigner and not your own lips do so. That was a scripture that came to mind today. Now, in the descent line from... I think it's Genesis chapter 10. Right. Look, Magog was the son of Japheth. Right. And it's interesting. And Mizraim was the son of Cush, or Ham, rather. The sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim, and Put, and Canaan. So Mizraim's in there. And there's also a person called Mestrium. That's probably the same person, it seems likely. In ancient Egypt, Mizraim was the founder of ancient Egypt. And Cush was, of course, the name of the land of Cush, which was Arabia at one time. So it's the same, it's just a little southwest of Shinar. Between Egypt and Shinar would be this land of Cush. And later on, Cush met Ethiopia, which was a part of Africa. And it was to the south of Egypt, in fact, in Africa, Egypt being in the northeastern portion, extremity of Egypt. So we know a lot about these things in general terms. And when we read our article now, we're seeing that because we have knowledge of very little, very few things in this time period. We need to keep it simple because we have very simple information. But there's a 22-year interval. Now, while the tower was built in Shinar, the connection of Shinar to Egypt was strong. Right. In other words, there was no other separation between Egypt and China at that time. There was no division between countries even at the time of Shinar. So Shinar was no different from Egypt. It was just a country where they lived, and it was just a place. It was the place. And then when they lived in Egypt later, that was maybe the second oldest place where they lived, and that was another place that was considered to be the same as Shinar, because it's just like if a company had different branches in the modern day, they have branch facilities in different locations, it's still the same company. So Shinar and Egypt were connected because they were just two groups that came from the same group. And we talked about this in our other work earlier, which we're going to eventually, hopefully, study and get back to later. But hopefully we will. But Mr. John Jackson, we said here, having asserted a 22-year interval from the fall of the tower to the king Thoth, who's an Egyptian Thoth, in the Blessed Genealogy, it would now appear to be 2706 of the Blessed Genealogy in the BCE years for the fall of the tower after 42 or 43 years when they were building, and 22 more years until the start of Old Kingdom Egypt in 2684 BCE in the Blessed Genealogy. So that's about right, because 2680 or so is known to be this, or believed by many people to be the start of Old Kingdom Egypt. 2681 or 2682 or 2680 or sometime very close to 2684. But let's leave this topic for the moment and consider instead the beginning of the Egyptian calendar itself. Because this is, of course, how we will arrive at what the time period was, I might add. I'll just add that in passing before we start doing the actual, is just a short discussion here, but before we do that, the Egyptian calendar beginning is what helps us to understand when these things occurred, because the Egyptian calendar was based on the phoenix cycle, or the rising of Sothis every 1461 Egyptian years. And so we can calculate back, knowing when there was a rising of Sothis in about the year 140 of the Common Era, we can calculate back to about the year 27, I should say. Well, we know 1460 times 2, is 2920. 2920 minus 140 is about 2780. That's about where we get to if we do the math. So we can calculate it very simply using simple math, because the Common Era, you know, is 140 years after the turn of the Common Era. So we subtract that 140, or roughly 140, from a number that's double 1460. Okay. We know there was also a rising of Sothis at the time of Seti, right? That's 1460 minus 140. So if we do that calculation, 1460, you can do it on your own calculator. 1460, let's just do rough numbers. 1460 minus 140 is 1320. We know that's roughly when Seti saw the rise of Sothis during his reign in about 1323 or 1324 BCE. Very close to being the time. for the rising of Sophists during the reign of Seti. That's interesting. Trying to think here. Yeah, I'm trying to think if we should be doing this in a way that's more accurate, or if this is, you know, or if we should be, if this is the right way to do it. But I think that's 1320. We get 1320 for that. But if I'd said 1461, right? And if I'd said minus 138, because it actually occurred in 139, let's say, then I get 1323, the exact number. So, I mean, it's possible to see how this could be true. Definitely. It's possible. It seems possible, for sure. But now let's say, so there was a rising of Sophists around the time of Seti, but then the one prior to that is the one that we're interested in, because that's the beginning of the Egyptian calendar, which is a few hundred years after the deluge, right? Or several, more than a few hundred years after the deluge. About 500 years after the deluge, the land of Shinar was inhabited and the Tower of Babel was built, right? And abandoned. And then Egyptian culture began shortly thereafter, 22 years after, according to Mr. Jackson in his book. So let's keep reading here. Now, okay, the date of Thoth I, named after the king Thoth, apparently, was intended to coincide with the rising of Sothis, the year of the calendar's inception. Now, that month might have been named after Thoth later on, too. It might not have been named after Thoth initially, because Thoth, at the beginning of the calendar, wasn't ruling as king. Perhaps, you know, I mean, it was at the time of Shinar, when they were building the tower, that this calendar began. In the year 27, well, let's take this number 1461, multiply it times 2, we get 2922, right? And then when we subtract 138, we get 2784. So that's about the time. But the fascinating thing about this too is we can calculate the rise of Sothis. It's calculated. So even if the Egyptian calendar years are not going to be exactly correct in terms of there being 1460 of them, even if there aren't exactly the right number, it's possible that the rising of Sothis didn't quite coincide with the Egyptian calendar cycles, so that that's okay. It just means they may have corrected their calendar based on the rising of Sothis, so we don't have to worry about it. But it's a period of very nearly 1461 years. Okay. So the date of Thoth 1 was intended to coincide with the rising of Sothis, the year of the calendar's inception, the very beginning of the Egyptian calendar now. And some people have speculated it might have been another 1400 years prior to the date that we're talking about also. Some people have speculated on those things, but because we have the Bible, we know we can arrive at the date of the deluge using the Bible. So we're able to arrive at the beginning of the Egyptian calendar also using the information we have about that, consistent with the Bible. So now this period, okay, the rising of Sothis, the year of the calendar, the Egyptian calendar's inception, or the calendar of the land of Shinar, which is the same as the Egyptian calendar, we're assuming they're the same because they were part of the same group of people, right, who eventually went to Egypt, or soon after went to Egypt. Okay. The date of Thoth 1 was the beginning of this calendar. It was the month of Thoth, the first day of the month, and it was the beginning of this great phoenix cycle, it was called, the rising of Sothis, every 1460 years, which would end on Thoth 1 after 1461 Egyptian years. The reason it's 1461 is because in Egyptian years they don't have a leap year, so after 4 times 365 they need another Egyptian year to fill in the extra quarter year that we would have at the end of each 365 years. So the year in which this occurs is determined by modern astronomical calculation. So children, you can ask your parents about that extra year there. The year in which this occurs is determined by modern astronomical calculation. We can do it, and I've done it using this program PLSV, using the Arcus Visionis that Ptolemy used, which is 11.0. The Arcus Visionis being the height at which the star has to be above the horizon before it can be seen. And that gave the value 2783 BCE. I just calculated 2784, which is very similar. 2783 BCE. But this was done using astronomy. Right? And we can do something else. We can use another method. Here it is, I think. This is using Cauchy. What happened? Well, here it is. Yeah. Using the tables of Rita Cauchy, the astronomer, her calculations, this is for the city of Alexandria. It's not as far north. Wait a minute now. It's still pretty far north. It's not as far north as the land of Shinar. But July, so it would be, it would, Sothis rises earlier if you go further north. Earlier in time. But this is actually in her table here, July 19th, Sothis rises in the year 2783 BCE, which is called minus 2782. That's the rising of Sothis at Alexandria in that year, assuming a few other things that she assumed for her calculation, which we won't go into, but it's fairly straightforward calculations that are done. So we're not going to go into all the intricacies at this point, just for the sake of simplicity. But I mean, it's basically a fairly simple calculation, apparently, and she arrives at this result. Now, why is that important that it's, or how do we know that it's July 19th? Well, okay, our calculator here, On the Will of Jehovah page, we put in a minus sign in the date for the year, and we enter the date 2783. She calls it minus 2782, but we call it minus 2783, and it's the same year. If we put that year in and we go to July 19th, the year, let's go to plus 3 also, if that helps any. But that's not going to change the calendar date. It's a Pegamena 5. So July 20th is, in that year, Thoth 1 in the Egyptian calendar. That's what this tells us. Thoth 1 is exactly July 20th in the year 2783. It says Thoth 1, or first Akhet 1. Thoth 1. So that's very similar, that answer. And as we go further north, we know it rises later. For example, it rose on July 18th at Memphis and July 14th or 13th at Thebes. So as we go further north, it's July 20th at Alexandria, perhaps, or well, but Rita Cauchy calculated it as I just showed, as we just showed, in as the 19th year in 2783 in her calculation. But you know, her assumptions can be changed. We can change her assumption. The numbers that she's using for the Arcus Visionis can be different, and if they are, then we can get a different date. So that's what we're going to talk about right now in this chapter here. we can calculate it using PLSV as well, which is called Planetary, Lunar, and Stellar Visibility. That was version 3.1 that I used when I calculated it, but Rita Gauci's calculated it, and we've seen it's very close to what the same numbers that we're getting. If we look at Rita Gauci's numbers, you see Thoth 1 is very close to this same time period in July. So if we were to go in any other year, we could go 4 years earlier, for example. If we went back 4 years to 2786, it would still be July 20th because it takes 4 years for that, for the calendar of the Julian calendar, which has an extra quarter day in it, you know, to change the Egyptian, to differ by one full day from the Egyptian calendar. It takes that long. It takes 4 years. So we can go back to 2786 and it's still July 20th. And then when we go one more year further back, it's now a Pagamental 5, yeah. But if I go 2785, I should say, 2785 is Thoth 1. And if I go 8432, it's still Thoth 1, but if I go 2781 BCE, it's Thoth 2, July 20th. So then I'd have to be July 19th for it to be Thoth 1. So the only time in history when it coincides with Thoth 1 is going to be 2780-something, right? It's the only time in history when we're going to get a coincidence with Thoth 1 around the rising of Sothis in July 20th or 19th, because the star Sothis always rises around that time, July 19th, in the Julian calendar, or at least for this time in history. It's always around July 19th, unless we determine a different date for the Arcus Visionis other than what Ptolemy used. Okay, then we could get, I'll give you an example. In the footnote here it says the date 2783 for the start of the Sothic cycle or Great Phoenix is measured at Memphis, and we calculated it. We didn't just look at the Egyptian calendar. We calculated it using astronomy and this program, PLSV 3.1. And it was using the Arcus Visionis that Ptolemy gave for the northern coast of Egypt, which is 11. To move the date as much as 3 years higher to 2786, we'd have to raise the Arcus Visionis only about up to 11.5 degrees, which is not much of a change. So it's not very improbable that we could be wrong by 3 years. It's still close. Within 3 years is an approximation for what the error, the expected error is, what we might expect the error to be. But it could be more than that too, but it's somewhere, that's a reasonable estimate of what the error, expected error is, which is a scientific term, the error expectant, the expected error is a scientific concept. Okay. So, this date, 2783, differs by 34 years from the birth date of Peleg in 2749. If we subtract 2783 minus 2749, the answer is 34. But that nears the death of Shem also. 2783 is very close to the death of Shem in 2780, which is determined in the Blessed Genealogy from what we talked about in the article Green, for example. Where's the article Green? Where was it? Here? Here it is. Right. 2780 was the death of Shem, but we know when the birth of Shem was, right? From in here. There's our Pakshed. He was the son of Shem. Okay. Shem does not even appear in this genealogy because we have the deluge, and Arpakshad was born 2 years after the deluge, so we don't need to know when Shem was born here. But Shem was 100 years old in this year 3280, And we know from the Bible how old Shem was when he died. So, how long after this did Shem live? 2,700, 500 years? Let's see. I know that we've done this. It's been done. It's been done. But let's look up Shem. Can we find it? Yeah. So it's in somewhere in paragraph of chapter 11 of the Bible where the descent from Noah was talked about. Right. Okay. It's in the articles too. Yeah. See, it says here in the Greek Septuagint, Shem lived after he became the father of Arpachshad. 500 years. Right there it says it. In Genesis chapter 10 or 11. Chapter 11. Yeah. Chapter 11, verse 11. Look at that. It's right in 11:11. We could find out. Now, it's not going to be the same in the Masoretic text, so we can't use the Masoretic text, you see. Because in the Masoretic text, we would have Genesis 11, verse 11, 400 years or something. No, it's the same. Good. It says 500. Very good. Oh, yeah, because in the Masoretic text, it's identical. It says he was 100 years old. Okay, good. That's perfect. There's no disagreement there between the two versions or the two manuscripts. So Shem lived 500 years after fathering Arpachshad, and Arpachshad was born 2 years after the deluge in both manuscripts. So isn't that wonderful? So that is wonderful. In the second year, it says after the deluge in the Septuagint, Shem became father to Arpachshad, and he lived after he became father to Arpachshad, 500 years. Okay, we are good there. So that 2 years after the deluge is, we know it's 2 years after our date for the deluge, which is 3282, right? So 3282 minus 2 is 3280. And 3280 minus 500 is 2780. It's a fairly simple 32 minus 5 is 27. So we have 2780 as the death of Shem in the Blessed Genealogy. And that's fascinating because that's very near to this time of 2783, which is the rising of Sothis and the beginning of the Egyptian calendar. And when Shem died, of course, that is very near to the time when this rebellion occurred in Shinar. So when we look at, if we look at, and we're going to look at it, but let's look at it here. We need to put this in a... Here we go. Let's try this. There we go. So, it's not in this book, is it? No, it's in this other copy of Manetho. Here it is. I think it's in here. Yeah. It's in the book of Sothis, right, where we find this description of what happened. At the time of the deluge, it talks about the Sothic cycle or the rising of Sothis cycle. And the dispersion took place in the 34th year of the rule of Arpachshad, right, which would be 34 years after Shem died. Fascinating. We just came up with that number 34 again in our own article because, of course, we knew this number was in this book here too. But 34th year of the rule of Arpachshad, so 34 years after 2780, because Arpachshad would start to rule when his father died, is what we're assuming here, right? That's what it means. When Shem died, his son Arpachshad, who then became father of Cainan, but he was the son of Shem, Arpachshad was, he began to rule then, it says there, well, it doesn't say what year he began to rule, but 34 years after he began to rule is when the dispersion took place, and that would be in the year 2780, which is the death of Shem, minus 34. right, which is 2746 or something like that. And we have the dispersion dated as about, but we have it as the fifth year of Phalek or Peleg. Peleg is the same as this person, Phalek here. We take that to be Peleg because that's the same form of the name here. As it's just a slightly different spelling of Peleg. So we have our Paksha, and the fifth year of Peleg is the dispersion, and we have the first year of Peleg is 2749 in our article, so that agrees well. The fifth year would be 2745, right? And we still want to keep it as the 34th year after the death of Shem in 2780. So it should be around 2746 or 2747, but we can't go that high because then it's not the fifth year of Peleg. So we put it in 2745, which is the best. It agrees best with both of those numbers for the dispersion date. But we haven't even talked about the dispersion. We're going to talk about that later. But that's roughly in good agreement. It's in excellent agreement with all that we know here about the rulership of these. And that book there was the Book of Sothis in the book called Manetho by Waddell. That's what that's from. It's on page 239 for that information about the Sothic cycle. It's a really, really interesting book, to say the least. But for us now, we're finished this study of the beginning of the Egyptian calendar for today in the Wild Road article. And now let's, God willing, let's do the study of Genesis chapter 22. This is a very powerful, is the word I would use to describe this, a very powerful chapter. It shows the kind of person that Abraham was and also the kind of person that Jehovah is, and how Jehovah performs his miracles also. It's quite a good example of some of the ways in which Jehovah works, the things that he does with his servants, how he treats his servants, such as Abraham, who was a servant of Jehovah. So Genesis chapter 22. Now, after these things, it came about that the true God put Abraham to the test. Accordingly, he said to him, Abraham, to which he said, Here I am. And he went on to say, Take, please, your son, your only son, whom you so love, Isaac, and make a trip to the land of Moriah, and there offer him up as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall designate to you. So Abraham got up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his attendants with him and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering. Then he rose and went on the trip to the place that the true God designated to him. Just got a bit of a tickly throat here. Just tickly. It was first on the third day. He was on a trip for 3 days. It was first on the third day that Abraham raised his eyes and began to see the place from a distance. Abraham now said to his attendants, You stay here with the ass, the donkey that is, but I and the boy want to go on over there and worship and return to you. I just took a little water to lubricate my throat. After that, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and put it upon Isaac, his son, and took in his hands the fire and the slaughtering knife. And both of them, that is, Isaac and Abraham, went on together. And Isaac began to say to Abraham, his father, My father! In turn, he said, Here I am, my son. So he continued, Here are the fire and the wood, but where is the sheep for the burnt offering? To this Abraham said, God will provide himself the sheep for the burnt offering, my son. And both of them walked on together. Finally, they reached the place that the true God had designated to him. And Abraham built an altar there and set the wood in order and bound Isaac his son, hand and foot, and put him upon the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham put out his hand and took the slaughtering knife to kill his son. But Jehovah's angel began calling to him out of the heavens and saying, Abraham, Abraham! To which he answered, Here I am. And he went on to say, Do not put out your hand against the boy, and do not do anything at all to him. For now I do know that you are God-fearing, and that you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. At that Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and there, deep in the foreground, there was a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. Yeah, that just reminded me, there is no such thing as past tense in Hebrew. It's only perfect or imperfect. So he looked could mean, it could mean he will look, could mean he did look in the past, or he has looked in the present, you see, and has these different perfect meanings. There was a ram caught by its horns in a thicket, and Abraham saw this. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it for a burnt offering in place of his son. And Abraham began to call the name of that place Jehovah Jireh. This is why it is customarily said today in the mountain of Jehovah, it will be provided. Because the word Jehovah Jireh means Jehovah will provide. And Jehovah's angel, proceeded to call to Abraham the second time out of the heavens and to say, By myself I do swear, is the utterance of Jehovah, that by reason of the fact that you have done this thing and you have not withheld your son, your only one, I shall surely bless you, and I shall surely multiply your seed like the stars of the heavens and like the grains of sand that are on the seashore, and your seed will take possession of the gate of his enemies, and by means of your seed all nations of the earth will certainly bless themselves due to the fact that you have listened to my voice. After that, Abraham returned to his attendants, and they got up and went their way together to Beersheba, and Abraham continued to dwell at Beersheba. Now it came about after these things that the report got through to Abraham, Here Milcah herself has also borne sons to Nahor, your brother. Uz, his firstborn, and Buz, his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Kesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. And Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, the brother of Abraham. There was his concubine, too, whose name was Roimah. In time, she herself also gave birth to Teba, and Gaham, and Tehash, and Maacah. These were the children of Nahor, the brother of Abraham. That's the end of Genesis chapter 22. Those are all children of the brother of Abraham. We often don't think about those people, those ones in the Bible that are closely related to Abraham, but because we're sticking with this study of the descent line of the sons of the patriarchs, and the son of Abraham was Isaac, and the son of Isaac was Jacob, and the son of Jacob was Joseph, and so on. We're concerned with the sons of the sons. We're not so much concerned with the cousins and the uncles and all of the relatives as we are with the one lineage in this case. And the reason is because, of course, we keep seeing in the case of Abraham that he keeps receiving more promise reiteration of the same promise from Jehovah, that by means of the seed of Abraham, in verse 18, all nations of the earth will certainly bless themselves, because Abraham listened when he was commanded. And in this case, he was commanded even initially to kill his only son. And he was obedient to the point where the angel saw, and Jehovah became aware through the angel, and because Jehovah could see too, that Abraham was going to kill his only son. So Jehovah allowed there to be a change of plan and for Abraham to take the offering from the ram that was stuck in a thicket nearby here, or within plain view, but perhaps a distance away from where Abraham was offering up his son. So Abraham was allowed to offer up the ram instead of his only son. And that way he could still make the burnt offering to Jehovah, and Jehovah was pleased with that and satisfied with it. But Jehovah doesn't make us suffer. He doesn't do things to make us suffer. That's not what his intent is, but he might do something because he's interested in knowing whether we're faithful. In this case, this is exactly what he did in Abraham's case. He wanted to know that Abraham was really faithful for whatever reason Jehovah has. We can't understand all the reasons Jehovah has for wanting to do things, but Jehovah wanted to do this, and once he knew that his servant Abraham was faithful, he allowed this, he had mercy, right? He took mercy upon Abraham, and he didn't require that Abraham offer up his son. This is a very important Bible principle. It's a very important thing. We might have many plans. Like, I might have had a plan. I was going to buy a watch, and I did buy a watch, by the way. But I was going to buy a watch, and it was going to be, I had to buy this watch. You know, Jehovah told me, you got to buy this most advanced watch. And so I shopped and shopped and shopped. And in the end, Jehovah allowed me to buy a less expensive watch. But it wasn't the cheapest watch either. I actually bought a very expensive watch. It was almost as expensive as, if you consider an iPhone to be a watch, which it is a timekeeping device, then it was almost as expensive as my iPhone, which I bought 6-7 years ago. The 6S for about $1,000. So, I mean, I paid $900 and something for my new watch, but I don't know yet whether it, you know, it's yet to be seen. I haven't seen it. I don't have it in my possession yet. But, well, when they ship it, that's when I'll be paying for it, I guess. But, and when I have it in my hands, that's when it will be mine. So, but I mean, I need to pray about these things. I bought a very nice watch. I didn't buy a Rolex or any of the major brand names, but I believe it was a very nice watch, a very good watch, and a Swiss watch too. Swiss, which is important. At least it's one of the technologies that is well known in watchmaking, and also there's Japanese watchmaking, of course. But and I could have gone that route. I could have gone with a Japanese watchmaker, and I still could. In fact, I could go with both. In fact, because the Japanese watches are much less expensive. At least so it appears to me, in my shopping that I've done. So I did buy a watch, and I bought a watch. I was pretty pleased with the purchase. I didn't overthink it when I came down to the final decision. I allowed there to be some spontaneity, and I realized that if I were to buy a watch that had all the stopwatch features, it was going to be a gigantic watch, and it was going to be many thousands of dollars. And, you know, if anything goes wrong with a watch that costs many, many thousands of dollars, it's more expensive to fix it, or to just, it's even, you know, it's more expensive no matter what happens. Whether you throw it away, it's going to be a huge loss in that case, or whether you fix it, it's still going to be a significant amount of money. But I didn't buy the cheapest possible watch, which is another thing I could have done. Instead, I bought a watch that probably will need servicing in order to maintain it for many, many years. It will need a lot of servicing at different times over the years, but I'm not planning that far ahead, really. I didn't think that was, it's not the reason I bought it. It was not so that I could service it. I bought it so that I could tell the time, primarily. And I suppose because I wanted to replace the watch that I have that was no longer functioning, so, and I wanted to buy something that was in keeping with the way that this watch, the old watch, looked. Something to do with the appearance of the old watch. I wanted to preserve some of that nature in the new purchase, which I think I did. So it's going to be interesting. I hope I get to show it to you fairly soon. And I'll be praying about that. And I want to talk about my health again. I think I'm essentially recovered, which is unbelievable. But, okay, but we don't know what caused it yet. It'll be possibly years before I understand fully what happened. But I believe that the drowsiness could be caused by vitamin A poisoning, and that I was taking a lot of vitamin A is an actual fact. And I believe that the frequent urination could be caused by vitamin D poisoning, and I was taking a lot of vitamin D, not more than vitamin A, in a relative sense of they were both nearly toxic levels, I would say. But also, the loss of weight could be explained by the iodine poisoning too, which I was also doing at a level that could be considered toxic for many people. So I may have had three different types of toxicity all at the same time. And now I don't think it's safe to resume vitamin D yet, but I'm taking 1,000 units right now. Yesterday and today I took 1,000 units of vitamin D, because I don't want to be totally deficient in vitamin D in case I'm not poisoned by it. I don't want to be completely devoid of vitamin D. So I'll be cautious with vitamin D, but I'm resuming my calcium intake, and I'm really enjoying my lattes again. It's apparently not causing me any problem right now. It might in the future, I guess, but it's not today nor yesterday, and it was before. When I was trying to take calcium, it was not a good thing. Of course, that also could have been the iodine I was taking with it too. That's possible too, right? Because I was taking iodine in the morning as a supplement with the lattes. But yeah, there's so many complications. I took vitamin D at the same time also, of course, when I was taking these lattes. But I really think that the calcium, I needed to stop the calcium for a number of days there. So how long did I stop the calcium? I don't know. It was a period of time of some days. Let's see if we can find it. Where did I mention toxicity is the question? The 19th, what day is this? Okay. Must have been. That's my income tax. Didn't I do that when I was suffering my toxicity? I think I did. Standards based on. I have something. I said, what is healthy? What are the standards for health based on? That was a question I wrote down here a while ago. But before we end our study, okay, so that was, I wrote that down on the 12th of March, because I was questioning what standards were based on, because that was the time when I'd been sick by poisoning. So I thought, right, well, here I had yogurt. Look, I had yogurt on the 13th of March. So I was still taking calcium at that time. Then I suspected an iodine overdose on the 16th. of March, so I hadn't stopped calcium, though. I had a latte on the 15th. Right. So I didn't stop calcium. I had a chocolate latte on the 18th. Didn't stop calcium until of course I didn't totally stop it. But I did for a couple of days I stopped calcium completely. I know I did, and I started to die. I mean I felt like all my energy was being sapped away from me. I couldn't, even though I ate a variety of other foods, I didn't want to eat tuna because I didn't want to increase my toxic mercury load from tuna being a large fish that accumulates a lot of mercury during its life. And our proverb for today was Proverbs 27:2, may a stranger and not your own mouth praise you, may a foreigner and not your own lips do so. The lesson from that proverb is we should let other people praise us. We shouldn't argue with them if they tell us that we're good or that we're skilled or that we're talented. We don't need to argue with them. We can let them praise us because it says, may a stranger praise you. As long as it's not your own mouth praising you, it's all right if other people praise us. So that's what we can learn from that scripture in Proverbs 27:2. So, yeah, I mean, today I'm eating almost everything. I'm going to start taking eventually all my regular supplements again, I think, except for vitamin D for the initial near term. But I don't want to complicate things, so I'll just introduce these. I'm still taking B12, vitamin B12. I'm taking the vitamin K2 in the MK4 and the MK7 forms, about 360 micrograms of each, MK4 and MK7. Every time I eat a significant amount of dairy, or about twice a day, I take 360 micrograms of each of MK4 and MK7 of the two forms of vitamin K2. But I don't take vitamin D with them. So I've got the forms isolated and separate from vitamin D, and that's how I can keep taking vitamin K2. But because I know that vitamin K2 is so important for everything in the body, and especially if we're eating calcium, we need vitamin K2. Especially, but if we do take vitamin K2, that enables us to eat significant amounts of calcium. Several small meals of calcium per day, for example, are easily manageable when taking vitamin K2. And if we're not poisoned by vitamin D, then we should be taking vitamin D with it also, because vitamin D and vitamin K2 work together. So, and then there's magnesium. I've got to keep taking that because that's essential for keeping water in the bowels and keeping the bowels functioning. I'm better in the health of my bowels now than I've been for many, many years. I know that because the bowel movement itself sinks to the bottom of the toilet, and it does it every single time, which it never used to do for a long time. And yet somebody on the internet who talked about this, who supposedly was knowledgeable, said it's supposed to sink to the bottom. It's not supposed to float on top. So I wasn't having healthy bowel movements for many years because my bowel movements were not sinking to the bottom. And now they are. At least if we believe what this person says. But again, we come back to the question, what's the standard for health? How do we judge what good health is? Who is the one who determines it, or upon whom do we base it? If we don't ever know it, a person who's completely healthy, how do we do it, right? So, I mean, it's somewhat in question, even if we have, you know, a group of people in the world now who are healthier than some of the other people, upon whom can we base the idea of a standard for health and do so reliably? That's a huge question. So the only way that I had believed recently was that if I want to have a standard for health, I have to be the standard. I have to become healthy, and then I can be the standard by which others are judged, rather than me judging myself by other people who aren't even healthy. That was my reasoning. I wanted to become healthy using the knowledge that was available that many people weren't using, such as the knowledge about vitamin K2. And I'm going to continue to do that as long as Jehovah allows me to keep living and thriving. And apparently my health has returned to a very high level, because I was up very late last night and didn't have the weakness like that I've been having when I stayed up. I didn't have the drowsiness. I could have stayed awake much longer if I needed to, or maybe not much longer, but I mean, I wasn't hitting this brick wall where I was just falling asleep. I was much healthier last night. So, I mean, it's going to be a hard battle for everlasting life, but it's one day at a time, right? Jesus is our Messiah. He's the one who's given his life to pay for the sin of Adam, so that we can put our faith in him and be redeemed from our own sins and learn how to live righteous lives in union with the Christian congregation, all of whom are in union with, or all of which is in union with Christ Jesus, the Messiah and the leader, the Prince of Peace, as he's also called. And Jehovah is very, very wonderful and very almighty, isn't he? He's almighty in the sense that he changed his mind about whether Abraham was going to have to sacrifice Isaac. And thankfully, he didn't have to sacrifice Isaac, so we did have the son of Isaac, Jacob, seeing his own birth. And we had his son Joseph being born, being sold into Egypt, and being placed there in that way as a remnant to save the family of Jacob when there was a famine. And when Jacob came into Egypt in 1914 BCE, as the genealogy records, as we've been discussing, and we can go all the way back to the beginning of the Egyptian calendar now, to 2780 when Shem died, and when the nation that became the nation of Egypt essentially began in Shinar, very near that time. And then we had the Tower of Babel, and eventually, not many years after that, the nation called Egypt, and the dividing of the land happened after, very shortly after the Tower of Babel. The land of the world was divided up among the tribes who had descended from Noah. They all got parts of the earth for themselves, and that's how eventually we have nations now. We have the earth divided into nations, national groups, that all came about because of the deluge and the Tower of Babel, and the confusion at the Tower of Babel caused the dividing up, the division between peoples that led to the dividing of the land. So this has been Ward Green. It's today still March 22nd, of course, March 22nd. Now the time is, it's the year 2023. The time is 21:34, daylight savings time. I nearly forgot to mention that. I love you. I love you deeply. I love you very much. Have a wonderful day. Don't forget what we've learned, and pursue peace, of course, and love. And remember, seek first the kingdom and Jehovah's righteousness, and all these other things will be added to you. Praise Jehovah. Bye for now.